Good morning. This morning we begin lesson number 22 in our long series, Rudiments Unto Perfection, the Whole Counsel of God. And today's lesson number 22 is entitled, Of Wrath and Indignation. Of Wrath and Indignation. It's important because we just talked about the last couple of lessons, God's wrath. Remember, I will execute my wrath upon the wall. Things like this, where the activities of men are subject to the wrath and judgment of God. And last week we talked about Isaiah 19 at length, how God executes his wrath upon a people whose face is toward Baal and Molech, in this case the gods of Egypt, and seduction of Israel. So now we want to talk about the flip side. If God is a God of wrath, which he is, no question about it, because it's a sinful world that deserves wrath to be executed upon it, and we are made in the image of God, where do we fit in? What part do we play in the execution of God's wrath and the satisfaction of indignation? Well, it turns out we don't play a role in God's wrath that isn't very, very carefully circumscribed, controlled, and defined in Scripture. A case in point would be Psalm 149, where people have always used that verse to even justify rebellions and uprisings, like in Germany. There was a famous uprising where this clause, this Psalm 149, was used to justify the overturning of cities and provinces and stuff like that. And the point of the matter is that this psalm has a protective feature in it. Protective feature in it. And that feature is executing upon them the judgment written. The written judgments of God, which are defined in the Old Testament Ten Commandments and the case laws, are specifically the only judgments that we're allowed to execute. We can't execute a judgment because this is a bad person or this is an evil fellow. You know, you need to have the judgment written. The judgment written even specifies who does it and what their relationship is to the man who's going to have wrath executed against them. For example, if it's the murderer, it turns out that one person or one set of people that are exempted from judgment and executing wrath is that person's immediate family. It is not biblically proper for one brother to be the killer of another. This was not, for example, the reason that Cain was not under the penalty of capital punishment, because everyone was his immediate family and God would not allow the family to turn in on itself. You'd have a civil structure that was later builded by God, if you will, and that was the means by which life was properly taken. This first command was given in Genesis 9 to Noah, and then was expanded with its principles in Exodus and finally Deuteronomy to its complete statement. So we must remember executing God's justice, yes. Executing the judgment of God, yes. Executing the judgment of God written, that's where we fall apart. Because we take unto ourselves our notion of what God's judgment is supposed to be. And this applies to every category of human life, every minute of every day, in our families, in our schools, in our businesses, where human anger and wrath and indignation arise. Because it turns out that even these things, getting angry at someone and flaring up, may well be an example of wrath that is not according to the judgment written. It might be illegitimate wrath. Because one thing that is as certain as any scriptural representation is that the wrath of man does not work the righteousness of God. The wrath of man cannot work the righteousness of God. So every time that we flare up, even if it's a righteous indignation, there's no guarantee, and sometimes frequently the absence of a guarantee and the certainty of the failure of God's righteousness to be implemented. See, because we fail at step one. We're not necessarily executing a judgment written. We are off on our own. We're taking wrath unto ourselves. We feel that our moral sense has been so outraged that we are now justified in our flare-up. When we get mad, we lose our temper, we shout and yell and fight and take revenge. Because in terms of that, a lot of what passes or is claimed to be biblical execution of judgment and moral indignation is in actual fact personal resentment being acted out under the pretext of being the biblically right thing to do, when it is, in fact is not. And we're going to look at two key passages, one from David and one from the major capital S son of David, that is David and Jesus, who obviously were both kings in a very, very real sense, the one the forerunner and symbol of the other, and see how they dealt with a situation, a very specific situation, where their moral indignation and wrath should, by human standards, have been outraged and inflamed to the point of lashing out and even taking people's lives. And they did the exact opposite of what we expected, and they rebuked those who sought to implement man's wrath. Though, on every indication, taking wrath looks to be justified. Let's take a look at 2 Samuel 16. 2 Samuel 16, verse 5. And when King David came to Bahurim, behold, thence came out a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. He came forth and cursed still as he came. And he cast stones at David and at all the servants of the king David, and all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. And thus said Shimei when he cursed, come out, thou bloody man, and thou man of Belial. The Lord hath returned upon thee all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose stead thou hast reigned. And the Lord hath delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom thy son. And behold, thou art taken in thy mischief, because thou art a bloody man. Now let's take a look at the content of this charge. Here's King David coming down with his whole kingly entourage. Mind you, it's at a time when he's got big trouble with Absalom, mind you. So let's not forget that. And David's got problems on his hands, serious problems. Nonetheless, he is the king. He's got all his court with him and his major soldiers. And this guy comes out throwing stones. He doesn't care about all the mighty men on the left and the right. He comes out into a crowd heaving rocks. And if he had bottles, I'm sure he would have thrown them too, but they weren't invented yet, at the king. And saying, come on, come out, you bloody man. You are responsible and are being paid back for blood on Saul's house. Saul's blood. You are guilty of the death of Saul and his household. Therefore, God is visiting you with this mischief, this punishment, with Absalom trying to rebel against you. So let's see what the statements are categorically arranged. You are a bloody man. You're guilty of blood guilt. You're a son of the devil. I'm going to throw rocks at you. I hate you. And if I could get close enough to hit you, I would with these rocks. I could kill you if I could, I'd kill you. Because he doesn't even care about what's going on around him. This man is hurling rocks at David and the people with impunity and casting up dust and everything. Then he also adds, he says, because of you murdering Saul and removing Saul, you tried to take his place and you're reigning in Saul's place. Therefore, you're responsible for the death of Saul. And then finally, the reason that Absalom had prevailed up to this point in time was because this was God's penalty for you being guilty towards Saul and being guilty of the death of Saul. Now, right out the door, if you will, David, if anyone was not guilty of the blood of Saul, it was David. He took extreme pains not to touch Saul. He had all these opportunities to blow Saul away. In fact, in a sense, maybe Saul deserved it. But in the deeper biblical sense, God honored David's restraint. I will not touch God's anointed so long as he's still the king. He's still the king. Doesn't matter. So David was totally guiltless. He was completely 1,000,000% innocent of these charges. Therefore, it must also be the case that he was innocent of the inference made by Shimei that this trouble upon your household is due to the fact that you are responsible for the murder of Saul. By the way, Saul committed suicide. But Shimei is not going to hear that. Shimei of the house of Saul, a Benjaminite, is saying and charging all this on David. He's hurling rocks on a false charge and even telling David, the reason that Absalom is blowing you away is because you deserted because of what you did to Saul. So not only do you have the false charge of which David is innocent, but then the inference being thrown at David that your trouble with your son is due to what you did to Saul. So this false story is now the pretext and the reason given why Shimei is rejoicing at what's going on. Because as far as Shimei is concerned, David brought this upon himself because he would not have had trouble with Absalom if he had done right before. And so obviously, as far as Shimei is concerned, David is proving his guiltiness regarding Saul because of what happened with Absalom. See, you would not have had trouble with Absalom except that you are a bloody man with respect to Saul. So we can see now that people will come to false judgment and conclusions about circumstances. They see, well, here's trouble with Absalom. Shimei, whose self-interest is at stake, by the way, being of the house of Saul, draws a false conclusion. But he pushes it, and he pushes it in public, and he's hurling stones at David while he's making this claim that you've come under the hand of your son Absalom, who's trying to destroy you because of what you did with Saul. And by the way, David does not even challenge this false statement, does he? As we read beyond, David refused to defend himself against an erroneous charge of which he was completely innocent, and of course of which the implication was faulty as well. David was not being blown away and having trouble with his son because of anything that he did wrong to Saul, because he did nothing wrong to Saul. So the entire line of argumentation was faulty. Nonetheless, here he is ducking and getting pelted with stones. And what is his response? Well, the first thing we want to look at is what was the response of those who were around him, of his trusted men. Verse 9, then said Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, unto the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over, I pray thee, and take off his head. Of course, they didn't hold Shimei in high esteem. This is pretty clear, since they regarded him not as just a dog, but a dead dog. Why should this bonehead come out here throwing rocks at the king of Israel like this with impunity and charging you like this? Let me go out there and shut this idiot's mouth, is the opinion of Abishai. And the king said, what have I to do with you, ye sons of Zeruiah? So let him curse, because the Lord hath said unto him, curse David. Who shall then say, wherefore hast thou done so? Now, he is asserting that it is God behind the cursing. Now, that's a strange circumstance, isn't it? He's saying God has bidden him to curse David. God, in other words, this awful event, this very embarrassing and potentially hazardous event where they're running into, which is humiliating to boot, because this guy is going unchallenged with false charges, false imputations, rock throwing, which, by the way, in Israel they shoot you for. They don't suffer this to occur in modern Israel anymore, because then out come the riot police for rock throwing. Well, this guy is an early rock thrower from early on, trying to nail a major Israeli. Of course, they're of the same family of Abraham, but different tribes. But boy, Shimei hates David. Now, David is innocent of the charges, innocent of the imputation placed and the inference drawn by Shimei, and yet he declares that it was God who sent him and bidded him to do this. Well, this is showing what a true providential view is. A providential view is even this false charge against me with the false imputation and this guy throwing rocks at me is part of God's providence. That is an unbelievable grasp of the providential view of what is befalling David. He is so secure in that all things are happening according to God that even a bozo coming up with rocks throwing at him with false charges and lies to humiliate him, he sees it as God being ruler over it too. In the same sense that Jesus knew that all the spitting and the hitting in the face and the ripping his beard out, God bid them to do so. Because by the determinate foreknowledge and counsel of God, Jesus was delivered up to do all whatsoever they will to him. And all these evils befell him. See? Just as Job, when the plunderers took all his stuff away, said, the Lord hath taken it away. Well, it was thieves and plunderers who ripped off all his stuff. But he saw the hand behind the human, the divine, powerful, almighty's hand behind the idiot shouting and throwing the rocks, in David's case, or in Job's case, seeing the divine hand behind the thieves who took all his stuff. And so what the disciples had a hard time seeing, which is why they fled when Jesus was delivered up to be crucified. They did not see God's hand in it. And that's a part of spiritual blindness. David, in this, what would seem to be a pretty serious, grim situation so far as his rule is concerned, his spiritual eyesight is 20/20. God has bidden him to curse me. Doesn't mean the curse is right or that there's any truth in the curse, but God has sent this man to afflict me. It's part of my affliction and it must be for my good. So in the false rebukes and reproofs, he seeks some solace, knowing that's from God, seeks what good there is in it. By the way, there is some good in it. good in it, so far as Shimei is concerned, is completely false because David was innocent of the blood of Saul. But David was not innocent of the blood of Uriah. So there was blood on David's hand, and he knew it in his own conscience. He didn't have to confess to everyone. He says, well, he's right, but it has to do with Uriah. I was responsible for his murder. It had nothing to do with it. He did not have to explain what his penitent meditations were and why he accepted the kernel of truth that was inside the savage attack for his own heart's benefit. But he knew that Shimei was sent, and even though everything was in the wrong direction and wrong-headed and totally false and humiliating the king of Israel, there was a hidden lesson inside which David was able to extract because he understood that God sent the guy. Apart from the fact that the entire message was false and all guilt, so far as the charge was concerned, was absent. It was a vapor. All right. So now we see a big difference between David's response, who sees the providential hand of God in an idiot and a bozo and a bonehead coming up with rocks throwing and glass and bottles, if he had it, to try to kill him on the spot in front of everybody, and the reactions of his mighty men, who say, why didn't this dead dog do this? Let's blow him away. Time to get this guy for this stupid thing. He's attacking the king of Israel, throwing rocks at him right in front of our eyes. If there were machine guns out, it would have been very short work of Shimei. So it's a totally different attitude between Abishai and the sons of Zeruiah, whom David says, you have nothing to do with this matter. He's cursing me, he's not cursing you, so don't feel ashamed for my sake. Don't feel incensed and indignant over my estate being attacked by Shimei, even though you know as well as I know that the exact content of his attack is faulty, is wrong, wrong-headed, and is purely an example of personal resentment on Shimei's part. Intense burning hatred and resentment of David is being manifested in these false charges. Nonetheless, that notwithstanding, David refuses to allow them to cut his head off. Let him curse. God sent him to do this. God sent him, and these false charges are going to keep flying, and the rocks are going to keep flying, because David said, leave him alone. You have nothing to do with what's going on with this bozo. David doesn't call him a bozo. He calls him this Benjaminite. So, what a big difference. Now we have to ask ourselves, how many times are we acting more like Abishai and lashing out immediately once our personal pride or bearing or stature is wounded by perhaps even false charges, or even maliciously false charges, as were Shimei's? And do we act as Abishai here does? Or do we act as David does? Okay. Give place to man's... But if God sent someone to afflict us with lies, God sent 400 lying prophets to Ahab, who knows what can be in God's hand? That's how incredibly overarching David's Calvinism is. He sees God's hand in such an awful event as this. In some, you know, dirty old flea-bitten Shimei coming out of his house and hurling dust and sand and sticks and whatever he can throw at David, and lying his teeth out in the process. And everyone knew it was false. David says, let him be. God has bidden him to do this thing. It's part of my affliction. Continue reading it here. It may be that the Lord will look on mine affliction and that the Lord will requite me good for his cursing this day. So I am looking that God will look upon my affliction, of which this is an added dimension, by the way, and that he will give me good, that there will be some good come out of this cursing. God, here's an absolute, perfect statement of good coming out of evil. David says, perhaps God will bring good out of this. I will look for God to deliver good. Because one of the things that David was most keen on, if you read through the Psalms, is searching his own heart. God, search my heart and remove all the unclean things, so I can have clean hands. See? This is one of the things that David held in high esteem as the signal element of pure worship of Jehovah, which he championed in the Psalms. So too here, this awful lies and defamation going on in front of everybody, he looks for the good in it and refuses to retaliate or allow others to retaliate on his behalf. He does not allow his wrath to come into play against Shimei, though apparently as far as the rest of the court is concerned, that would make good policy sense. Don't let this guy get away with it. Silence the bonehead. God sent the bonehead. That's the way to put it. God sent the reviler. So verse 12, the keyhole point. We need, rather than to exercise personal wrath and resentment and indignation, to look at 2 Samuel 16:12 and suffer under the affliction and pray and hope that God may in fact requite us good for the cursing that was unjustly delivered against us. That is the providential view. If anything can be termed to be a providential view of history and of man, God's hand in the events of man's lives, this is it. To the extent that we act like Abishai, we cut ourselves off from the blessing that God would have given us, that verse 12 implies exists for those who suffer quietly and bear up under these kind of afflictions. Of course, one of the afflictions that we bear under is false accusations. Christians are told in ahead of time. They'll bring you up before tribunals and charge all sorts of false things, and maybe you will suffer, blah, blah, blah. There should be no surprise to a Christian, and that it should come from any quarter imaginable, secular quarter, ecclesiastical quarter, that is the church, from the family even can become false revilings. We see examples of this multiply throughout church history. Even in the between husband and wife, we can see horrendous conflicts and conflagrations, as in the case of Wesley, for example. So look at verse 13. As a consequence of seeing how totally providential David looks at this matter. And as David and his men went by the way, Shimei went along on the hillside over against him and cursed as he went and threw stones at him and cast dust. Now that David refused to let them do anything, they start moving along. Guess who keeps following? This guy is up on the hill above them, and he's following along the side as David and his party are marching, and he's still grabbing every rock he can and hurling it at David. He wasn't satisfied just with popping out of his house and starting to hurl the stones. He gets up and follows them and keeps trying to knock David, hit him in the head with a rock. Who of you and I have suffered worse humiliation unrighteously at anyone's hands as David has done here at Shimei's, including physical harm? How many of us have had some guy yelling and using foulest language imaginable against us for things we didn't do and trying to actually put a rock or bottle through our head and look at that and say, let him be, it's God sent him. Who of us can rest so assured? You know, this is one of those things that in my book comes close to Abraham's sacrificing his son in terms of some unbelievable strength of will to accept God's rule over our lives. Just as Abraham was willing to offer up Isaac, would not withhold his own son, so now David, what tremendous control over his spirit, not to act as Abishai and these sons of Zeruiah who are ready to take this guy out fast and cut him his head off. This is the standard, folks, for the Christian, believe it or not, because we see Jesus going to do the exact same thing in Luke 9. This story almost, as far as I'm concerned, is going to become a complete repeat in almost all the major details in terms of an indignation and humiliation done and Jesus' main men ready to take vengeance upon it and Jesus forbidding them to do so. So here, David forbidding them to do so, and the abuse continues. What we should learn here is that if David can handle this, all the lesser tribulations of life and all the lesser offenses that come against us, certainly we can take a providential view of them. And you know what will happen if you do? Okay, perhaps you may end up humiliated without a defense. But you know what would be better than that? Is having God bless you with good through that affliction. Because that'll be a deeper blessing than if you just silence Shimei. See, the quick fix is to silence Shimei. The long-term fix is in David's heart, which is blessed, believe it or not, by enduring the affliction, because it now expands the barriers, if you will, of David's faith in God. His ability to rest secure in the arms of the Almighty, even respecting such a humiliating, loud, raucous event as this. Raucous, also raucous, event as this, of the hurling of the stones from the really upset Benjaminite. I can't bring this lesson home any more powerfully because I'm not a great eloquent preacher, but I hope that at least we're absorbing the content of what's being put forth here. Don't give place to man's wrath. Don't indulge indignation because it may be a pretext for a resentment. Certainly this is as far as Abishai understood it. He understood only at the human level. He resented the fact that his king was being abused and defamed and reviled like this without challenge and falsely to boot. And David would not allow anyone to indulge their righteous indignation, because it wasn't going to work God's righteousness. Man's wrath in this case was not the judgment written, believe it or not. For openers, they should listen to the king anyway, and they were right to ask the king first. Why should he be allowed to do this? Let's go and give us bid and we'll take off his head. So they rightly went to David first to ask permission. And we'll see that the disciples did the exact same thing. That's why these are almost perfect parallels in Luke 9. They asked Jesus first, shall we destroy them? No. Well, the answer is no in both cases, in spite of the indignation. This is an astonishing story. Astonishing. Verse 14, and the king and all the people that were with him came weary and refreshed themselves there. And Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem and Ahithophel with them. And it came to pass, when Hushai the Archite, David's friend, was come unto Absalom, that Hushai said unto Absalom, God save the king, God save the king. Let me make sure I'm finding the right passage here. Oh, I'm looking at verse 11. That's what I wanted to have. I missed it, and I apologize. This was part of the response. And David said to Abishai and to all his servants, behold my son, which came forth of my bowels seeking my life. How much more now may this Benjamite, I guess apparently, do it? Let him alone and let him curse, for the Lord hath bidden him. All right, here's an interesting contrast. If my own son who came out from my bowels is now seeking my life, how much more should this Benjamite come after me? You see what David is saying? There is a rupture of the most major sort in the most intimate relationship he has, which is with one of his own sons. You know, that is such that he's trying to take my life. How much more would more distant relationships, like being relative of one of several million relatives or descendants of Abraham, if the near relations are in bad order, how much more should I not expect this guy, descendant of Benjamin, to go after me? One point that he's saying, of course, is that this is a minor matter. Shimei yelling and screaming at me, why, what's the point? It's minor. Look, my own son's trying to kill me. This is minor in comparison. Look at the fact. So he draws a tremendous contrast. If my own son comes from my own bowels, is trying to seek my life, then how much more should this Benjamite now do so too? You know, this is a lesser evil of anything anyway. So, as far as David was concerned, his affliction was much greater on the account of his trouble with Absalom than any problem that he's got with this guy. Now, that tells us several points. Probably the deepest spiritual lesson for us is look how he regards his situation. He's oblivious, providentially oblivious, to this guy screaming, yelling, throwing rocks at him because his mind is more on his son. So he's not taking time out to kill this Shimei guy. He's saying, Absalom, O Absalom, as it were. His heart is reaching out to his rebellious son. Wrongly, in a sense, because it's a misplaced, but we must realize that there certainly is a tremendous strife in his family at the moment. And in comparison with that, the other things are minor. So I think this gives us a real important idea of how important, a real firm idea of how important the family really is. Yes, David had a providential view of God and of his dealings with men, but it seems to him that even having rocks thrown in the back of your head and being reviled and attacked viciously and maliciously by some character from the tribe of Benjamin is totally irrelevant and of no significance compared to what his main concern is, which is finding a way to redeem his son from the error of his ways. So I think that there's a secondary lesson here, is that if we are on target in terms of our main focus, attacks that are even false and malicious against us will be so minor that we'll say they're of less significance than the main thing I'm concerned about, which is my children. You don't even need to have an Absalom situation. You can just be so focused on your good children becoming better, which is your main charge in the world as a parent, for example, is your children. Not a school, not a governor, not a president, not an army officer, but your children. Not even a pastor. The children are the first focal point of the parents. And this is why David's response is correct. And we see that because his eyes are focused on Absalom, because he's the father, he's responsible for his son, he wants to redeem, see his son redeemed, his son is trying to kill him, that focus allows him to put all of the considerations as too insignificant to deal with. And because those other things add affliction, he providentially turns and says, I trust, and perhaps God will requite me good for the cursing done to me this day. Okay. Let him curse, for God has bidden him to do so. So we see again that one of the strengths that allows us to look past indignations that would otherwise outrage us and cause resentment to flare up is to have a focus on the most important things. Notice just the wrath that flared up in the story of Mary and Martha. One's busy setting tables, getting food ready, the other's sitting at Jesus' feet. And the one who was busy comes up and says, Lord, you rebuke my sister, have her help me because I've been doing it all myself. And Jesus makes the point, you worry about many, many things, but only one thing is needful. See? Focus is so important. That doesn't mean all other things are obliterated, but they're put in their proper priority sequence. The first and greatest commandment, then the one second is like unto it, and all the rest hang from that. We need to have proper focus. Proper focus allows us to have a providential view of history, and it's not presumptuous at all at that point. But if we don't have that focus of our family first, or as an individual, God first, and even God over family in the case of Abraham, and here in the case of David, family over civil rule, he's more concerned about Abraham than the protection of his throne from false imputation, which is the correct thing to do, by the way, we'd have a much easier time of it. So here we see David making it very clear what the proper focus is. He's worried about Absalom. This Benjamite is a minor matter in comparison, therefore doesn't deserve the venting of wrath. Let him curse. God sent him anyway, and hopefully some good will come of it. We need to be that oblivious to these other things, because what this is telling us is that all offenses are minor compared to how God's going to hold us responsible for our families. David was held responsible, by the way, for Absalom's final destiny. Because David did do a little bit of the Eli act, as we read from Judges 2. All right, turn with me now to Luke 9. We'll see what the corollary account is in the New Testament, since we discussed the Old Testament example at length. Verse 51. Luke 9:51. And it came to pass, when the time was come that he should be received up, he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem. So now the target is chosen. Jesus is going to Jerusalem. There's no question, even the path that he's taken is facing Jerusalem. There's no question that he's heading up to Jerusalem. And that's an important part of the story, is the location or the destination. Because apart from the destination, we're not going to understand why he receives ill treatment at the hands of Samaritans. Not only that, it says he resolutely set his face toward it. Steadfastly set his face, or more literally, resolutely set his face to go to Jerusalem. In other words, there's no force on earth that's going to stop him from heading up to Jerusalem, and it's going to be a beeline, a strong beeline. He does a courtesy in verse 52. Jesus sends messengers before him. It says, and they went and entered into a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. And they, that is the Samaritans, did not receive him, because his face was as though he would go to Jerusalem. There's the reason why. The Samaritans would not receive him because he's going to Jerusalem. Why is that? The sole reason for which they said, you're not allowed to even walk through our town. You go around. We don't want you anywhere near us, because he's going to Jerusalem. If he was going another direction, they would have let him in. But because he's going to Jerusalem, they refused him. They knew that he was ill-treated of the priests in Jerusalem and the rulers. And they thought that Jesus would then be most welcome at Mount Gerizim to worship where the Samaritans worshipped. But Jesus pointed out, neither in Jerusalem nor on this mountain, but in spirit and in truth shall the Lord be worshipped. But here, because he is showing forth his endorsement, apparently because of his direction of the Jewish position, after all that befell him, they just had no more patience with Jesus, not understanding that he was not going there to be received as a king at all, but to die. But as far as they were concerned, he was like any other Jew at that point, just Jerusalem bound, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. We don't need any more of that garbage Jerusalem. Mount Gerizim is the right place to worship, so far as we Samaritans are concerned. Don't even let them walk through here. Keep them out. Show our resentment. We're indignant that this person turns his back on the Samaritans. We thought he was for us. We thought he was a good teacher. We heard about him. Now I find out that he kowtows to the Jews up in the Jerusalem sector. This did not go well with the Samaritans. They did not like it. One iota. Even though Jesus did all the right etiquette by sending the messengers ahead of time, he didn't just barge in. He sent messengers ahead to try to arrange things. Showed tremendous courtesy as a result. And yet he was despitefully treated in this instance. Verse 54, and when his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Lord, wilt thou that we command fire to come down from heaven and to consume them, even as Elias did? Well, here is the situation where these boys are acting just like Abishai. Here is this awful, I mean, they wouldn't even let them walk through. They had to go, why not? Why couldn't they just go through the town? They didn't have to stop there. They're not even allowed to enter the town. They were arrayed to keep him out, to make his path more difficult. Yet here is the King of Kings, and they're going to make him go around this town. And so in the same sense that when Shimei was cursing people around David, were really upset about the and resented this humiliation and shame put upon their king, so too the disciples, knowing everything that Jesus did, I mean, everywhere he goes, he does good. He heals thousands and feeds thousands. And this guy, this town here, reports that they don't want him anywhere near the town. They wouldn't allow him to even cross through its center. You want us to call fire down. Now notice, they even have a biblical warrant. They quote scripture and saying, like Elias did. Remember, Elijah called the fire down and boom, it came. We want to give them as Sodom and Gomorrah got, because they turned the Lord away. So righteous indignation is flared up inside the disciples. They're jealous for Jesus' cause and his honor. But there are other things that they're missing that are more important. See, we have to realize, how many times do we get our righteous indignation flaring up and become like the sons of thunder and want to say, let's take care of it. It's time now for God to go to work, because, and my hands are going to be more than happy to take matters into our own hands and correct this horrendous injustice that's being perpetrated against so-and-so or me or him. See? But Jesus does not allow it. But notice that even the judgment is phrased in a biblical way. They even give an example, like Elias did, just as Elias. Okay? So they're citing an example of Elias bringing the fire down on Mount Carmel in the same manner that God brought fire down on Sodom and Gomorrah. They had no doubt that they had the power, by the way, to do this thing. The trouble is that Jesus did not come to do these kind of things. They totally missed the boat of what Jesus came for and why they were sent into the world in the first place. Verse 55, but he turned and rebuked them and said, ye know not what manner of spirit ye are of. Now Jesus is saying this is a spiritual problem, and it's a serious spiritual problem, because the first thing he says is, you do not know. You do not realize. You do not see. You do not think. You don't realize. You're not coming under the overwhelming knowledge of the fact that the spirit of which you're speaking of is not a good one. So the first thing he points out is that they are blind to the fact that this tremendous urge of indignation couched in biblical language, even citing doing to them what Elias did to the sacrifices, the wetted sacrifices, and the appeal to, you know, righteous indignation being executed wrathfully on this town that, as far as they were concerned, deserved it. They are blind to the fact that the spirit which motivates this opinion or this plan is not of Christ. You do not know what spirit ye are of. When you say these things, you are not realizing, because if you realize it, you wouldn't say it. It's a basic implication. If you realize what spirit is behind this question, to go in and execute wrath, execute judgment against these people, you would not do it. But they say it because they do not realize. And that now that becomes an interesting problem, because how do you cure someone of blindness? How do you tell someone who's blind what the color red is? How do I tell someone who's blind to the spirit that's in them that the spirit that's in them is not good? Because as far as they're concerned, everything is good about it. Everything is righteous about it. Everything is biblical about it. just as it was here. They urged everything, even a biblical example, even a biblical context, to go ahead and wipe out this Samaritan city. Level it to the ground. Nuke it. God style. But it turns out that there's a defect in the heart and spirit of this plan. And the defect is such that they can't even see the defect. Now, whenever God tells us that there's something that we cannot see, but it's the thing that's driving us to our actions, we better really be willing to stop and take a look. If I said, there's an invisible wall right there, so you better not walk into it, and you walked over there and you hit it, I said, good God, there was an invisible wall there. I should have listened. But it was invisible, of course, so its reality was doubted right off the bat. So we should really take it very seriously when God is saying this is an area of human blindness where most people are not going to see the Spirit, which is driving their thinking and planning and doing. Their deeds are being driven forward by a spirit that is not of me, though it sounds and looks like me because the quotations were biblical and the response was a righteous indignation. But the wrath of man was not going to work the righteousness of God. You see? And the other point is that the righteousness of God doesn't work the wrath of man, which is the reverse statement. Because they are trying to say God will righteously judge them. But they were trying to put God's righteousness, which they believe should have been inflamed by these actions, put God's righteousness into the service of their resentment against the Samaritans. See? And that's exactly what Shimei was pulling when he said, all your trouble with Absalom is due to the fact that you are responsible for Saul's death. Took his throne away. So, two, this same plan is happening here. They're laying at the Samaritans what they believe is God's judgment against them. So, give the word and we'll pull the fire of God's judgment on down. And they're not realizing, they're trying to say this is God's judgment, but it wasn't. It wasn't God's wrath on the Samaritan city, it was man's wrath. It was human resentment and jealousy for Christ's honor. But it was misplaced because the spirit of it was motivated more by hatred of the Samaritans. Really. Because this action would have suited these guys just fine to blow away some Samaritans anyway. It would have suited these guys at David's time to get rid of this loudmouth Benjamite with the stones who was kept pelting them. It would have been a convenient thing to do to get him out of the way. And there was such enmity between Jew and Samaritan, there's no surprise that these two Jews would offer to blow away the Samaritan city. So what was actually operational here was not, it was under the pretext of being a righteous, godly judgment against the city, but in actual fact it was a human wrath, a man's wrath being planned. What a big difference that can be. Because it's a different spirit, isn't it? The spirit of godly judgment is executing upon them the judgment written, which has a whole bunch of qualifications, restraints, systems, checks and balances, witnesses, all that stuff, discretions, and versus this bald statement of the disciples. Verse 56, for the Son of Man is not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. And they went to another village. You see, you do not know what spirit it is, because now he tells them, the Son of Man did not come to destroy. You totally misunderstand why I'm here, and the fact that Christ's honor is impugned, and humiliated, and reviled, and insulted, does not call forth God's judgment because he didn't come to destroy. This was anticipated ahead of time. He came to save so that there wouldn't be these kind of offenses anyway. See, what God came to do was not to destroy enemies, but to destroy all enmity between people. What a big difference, see? He didn't come to destroy the enemies. God's enemies, he's trying to destroy the enmity between God and man. And that means that that's our calling as Christians to do the same thing, not to go destroy our enemies, or those we perceive to have become our enemies in some sense, but to destroy enmity, or that sense of opposition and conflict between ourselves. And that comes by having a providential view, which David gives us very clearly in the back passage. You know, these things will be forgiven. All sorts of offenses can be forgiven except the one against the Holy Spirit. So Jesus makes it very clear. He did not come to destroy. But we act like he did. You did not come to tear down or to rebuke or attack per se, except to the extent that it would deliver from sin, to save and gather that which was lost. As a hen gathers its chicks, that was Jesus' plan. And here, after all these years, several years of discipling with these guys, they want to go out and blow up a Samaritan city and nuke it. Totally missing the boat, you see. Which tells us that our sense of indignation is something that's boiling and bubbling and fizzling underneath the surface of our souls, ready for the least little thing to activate it, to trigger it, so that we can fly off the handle and give vent to our human wrath. We've got to be really alert to this, because the spirit that moves that forward is not of Christ. You do not know what spirit ye are of when you make these comments. And it means against anything that insults, rebukes, reviles, maliciously attacks you, regardless of what it is, or attacks someone else that you know. Because, of course, the person that we should be most concerned about under attack is Christ himself. And that was the person who was being insulted directly here, and Jesus forbid them to take any matters into their own hands. They just sought a peaceful way to go, and they went around the city rather than going through it, which it was his right to go. It was the king of Israel. Why couldn't he walk through a city in the region on his way to Jerusalem? He walked around it. Jesus walked around it with his group. Didn't seek a fight, didn't seek to press his cause and his righteous claims upon the Samaritan city. He went around it. There's a big lesson there. He avoided the conflict. In other words, he acquiesced in the insult. The Samaritans prevailed and failed to allow Jesus to go through. By the way, it should be pointed out, there's no guarantee that every single member of that city or that town was against Jesus coming. Might have been just a handful who the disciples talked to who said, we don't want him in here. But it could be there might have been thousands in the city who would have welcomed Jesus and said, heal our children, we want to hear from you. So if God was unwilling to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, if even 10 righteous men were there, what justification do these two disciples have to blow away a Samaritan city where there might be thousands of righteous people just because the city rulers might have said, beat it, go around, you're not welcome here, to Jesus. See? There are a lot of considerations that are not in the text that when you think about it, sure make the disciples' suggestion awful in comparison, that they would have sought to justify nuking this city with brimstone and fire from heaven just because maybe a small minority who perhaps held the keys of the city, so to speak, and ran it, told them to go around the city, that they were not allowed to go through it. Why should all these people in the city suffer simply because of the ill will and insulting behavior of a few? That doesn't make sense. That's not God's way. I think this is a secondary feature in the story that we need to come to grips with, which is to say, many times when we vent our human wrath, let's just say that Jesus said, go ahead, and they blew him up, and would have come out, hey, 8,000 innocent men, women, and children who were friends of Christ and were cleaving to him were killed in the process because he happened to be in the city, and the city rulers just happened, to refuse Jesus' passage. We need to be aware that that this is one of the biggest signals that this passage can tell us when you think about that aspect is that when man vents his wrath, innocent people can get hurt. People who don't need to get involved in a conflict get pulled in, with whom God has no argument or fight or battle. We've seen situations where say an entire congregation might get pulled into a conflict that really was limited to maybe a few, and the damage becomes widespread, and spirits bruised and wounded simply from being bystanders and spectators of these conflicts and battles. Unnecessary. Not called for. Okay. The wrath of man, every time it works apart from the written judgments of God, which gives very explicit details and protects us from these kind of over-floodings of man's wrath into illegitimate areas, every time we fail to observe these things, there is a widening circle of pain. It's that simple. And it's needless. And it's all because we don't take the providential view that things that are coming upon us or upon others may be God's hand. They may be afflictive, They may be even false. There may be all sorts of elements in it which raise our moral indignation to a high fever pitch. Nonetheless, that notwithstanding, we can take a providential view. We do not work a man's wrath, but we can, of course, work after the judgment written. And we talk about the judgment written, that means whatever the governmental systems that are presently in existence, you work through them. And up until the point where you come to Acts 5:29, we must serve God or obey God rather than man. At that point, there must be a breach if all other peacekeeping has failed. See? But we can also see how it is that Jesus went around the city, meaning you don't need to force your way through and have your way. He was had his head set for Jerusalem, and he wanted to go there without stopping, and he had to make a side trip. He had to go a farther distance, out of his way to get there. He still got to where he was going. We all know that. It took him a little longer because he had to walk farther. And that insult and indignation was brought upon him because of the rulers, apparently, of the Samaritan city. But he didn't force his way through. He went around. In other words, he removed himself from the source of the indignation and got to where God wanted him to go anyway. And he did not work the wrath of his disciples, did not allow them to indulge it and entertain it. And he warned them, and he warns all of us, that the spirit which seeks vindication, exoneration, all these things, if it is in a wrathful sense, if it is in a sense that is not strictly defined by what God allows in his judicial system, it's going to magnify and enlarge the circle of pain and suffering. If you keep the affliction to yourself, as David does, and he only shares it for the benefit of those around him who immediately want to know why on earth he's not handling Shimei, he says, perhaps God will give me, requite me good, that is, deliver me some good out of the cursing. That's the appropriate attitude. If anyone had power to have Shimei struck dead, it was David. If anyone had power to allow the disciples to bring down the fire and brimstone, it was Jesus, and they both declined. So we, who are far less powerful and have far less of a reach with our hands, because our arms are waxed short, so to speak, compared to God's, what have we to do upon insisting on our rights when we can allow a false testimony to go unchallenged and simply ask and pray that God show us the good in it and deliver good into our lives through it? That is how we say, remember what Joseph said, what you meant for evil, God meant for good. What Shimei means for evil, and it's evil in every sense of the way, because it's false, it's a lie, and it's attacking, and he's trying to do physical harm, kill David if he could, get close enough with a big enough rock. God means it for David's good. Okay? We got to take that mindset. It's a serious Christian mindset. Anything, to the extent that your heart differs from this attitude of David's, to the extent that God's going to have to teach us to forbear. This is not, by the way, give license to any unrighteousness when we have judicial callings. And I want to make sure that the counterbalance to this is God's righteousness is replete with written judgments that are required to be executed. Child sins to be corrected, but potentially with the rod. That's simple. Man murders, life must pay with his life, unless it was manslaughter, in which case he needs to flee to a Levitical city. All these things listed. Man steals, must return, plus penalties, depending on the nature of the theft. All these must be pressed as God's distinctives, because judgment fails and justice fails, and God is very interested in having justice prevail. Should be the righteous nation, a city of justice where justice dwells, is God's calling for all nations, not just Jerusalem. And that means that we must be alert to biblical law and applying it left, right, front, center, back, front, you name it, top to bottom in society. Church society, family society, civil society, all spheres must be put in line with that. But that's a far cry from saying that we need to indulge all moral indignation, because we don't know what spirit we are of when we go and attack in kind. So there's a right and a wrong way. Jesus could have sat down with the Samaritans and reasoned with them. David could have said, let's have a little powwow with Shimei, I'll straighten him out about this Saul bit. No, didn't have to. Didn't have to do it at all. They accepted the affliction and the insult and the indignation as a character-building element in their hearts that God was going to use. very critical. And it really blew their hearts up wide open to the true God, just as Abraham probably had a tremendous realization of what God was like when he was allowed to spare his son Isaac, who was ready to strike with the knife. And there was the ram stuck in the bushes. God did provide another sacrifice. So to David. And now we, as disciples of Christ, must be wary of not walking in the spirit of the sons of thunder when we're not called to. Zeal is great, but zeal misapplied is bad. It's going 90 miles an hour in the wrong direction. Zeal is great. It gets you going at high speed, but it must be directed by wisdom. And we must rule our spirits. All this to say is that moral indignation is something that gets out of hand in a Christian. We can fire it up real quick. We can throw pictures on a television set of all sorts of abominations and atrocities that go on in a society. Then we go out and do the wrong thing in response, because we've been all heated up and hyped up against something, and we're incensed that they're doing this to the churches and doing that to the churches. They're padlocking this and they're breaking that, and they threw this guy in jail. But you can only go so far in emotional heat, and it peters out real fast. There's no substance to it, because the spirit of it is not Christ-informed. We need to see things through David's providential viewpoint. And when we do, we coexist better ourselves. We gain that benefit of the good from affliction, by the way, which is a very hard thing to work out in our lives. I'm not going to get good out of being afflicted by somebody. That's God's job. Our job is to acquiesce in it to the extent that we're able. God will increase grace. We pray for these things. It'll happen. David was probably quite an advanced along and been in many, many battles. So his growth was at a mature stage here. We need to get to this point. This is the target zone. Don't guarantee that all of us are going to be walking like David and can take a shimei for half hour of brutal verbalizations and physical attacks. But that's the goal. It's pure and simple. Maybe 20 years from now we'll be closer to it. But we have to work toward it. And if we know, boy, I'm pretty hot-tempered about things, when I get upset and I realize that, something is really wrong and my sense of righteousness is flared up, well, we might be a little bit hard to teach, but we certainly can work on our children. No reason why this temper should stay with us. I mean, it should stay with us in the sense that it shouldn't be passed on, communicated to our children, so that they would have rule over their spirits, as did David, and truly see and discern God's hand behind even the craziest things that happen to us, including getting beaten up on the way from school and stuff like this. Who knows what God may have in mind in the way of a character-building affliction that is totally unmerited, of which we're totally innocent. That's the kind of thing that really gets us. Remember what Peter said? I would have that none of you suffer as a thief. But he doesn't seem to mind us suffering for being innocent. This suits Peter fine, because he's walking in the same proper spirit of Jesus, as well as, obviously, David. Any questions about our lesson on wrath and indignation? Good.